In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
So you've just been down to your local healthcare professional and they said to you, look, you've got osteoarthritis, your joint's decaying. There's not much you can do because you're getting old. You may as well just rest because this is a one-way street towards continual decline. And in time, you're probably going to need to have surgery to fix that problem. You walked away, understandably, discouraged and dismayed because you thought now your joint is failing. There's not much you can do about it. You're going to continue to become increasingly sedentary. And all of those enjoyable activities that you used to take immense value from, you're not going to be able to do for a long period of time until you get that surgical fix. Those beliefs are incredibly common out there in the community and come from lots and lots of different perspectives, whether that be through healthcare professionals, through friends that you might have that have osteoarthritis, that have similar attitudes towards their disease. But by reframing that content about the beliefs and your knowledge and understanding of osteoarthritis, we can definitely change the way you have a perception about the illness and about what you can do proactively about managing this disease and regain control over this condition. Today, that's the topic we're talking about. It's pithy, it's content rich, but it really digs into a lot of those misconceptions and inappropriate beliefs that lead to, unfortunately, continued decline and sedentary behavior. So we're going to talk about those beliefs, talk about reframing those beliefs and the benefits of so doing. And we're doing that with Ben Darlow, who we have the privilege of chatting to today. Ben's an associate professor at the University of Otago and a musculoskeletal physiotherapy specialist based in Wellington, New Zealand. Hello, Ben. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, David. It's lovely to be here.
Oh, it's absolutely our pleasure and really looking forward to having this conversation. I think it'll be incredibly valuable for our audience. But before we get into that, just in an effort to get to know a fellow New Zealander a little bit better, can you share with the listeners a little bit more about your background and what a typical day looks like?
Yeah, sure. So I'm from Wellington in New Zealand, but I grew up in Ohakuni in the centre of the North Island of New Zealand by the mountain Ruapehu as well. And so that's also part of, I guess, my identity and whom I am and where I feel like I come from. I'm a physiotherapist by trade, and I practiced solely clinically for, I guess, about the first 15 years of my career. But when doing that, there were questions that came up within my practice that I couldn't necessarily find answers for in the literature. And so at that point, I embarked on doing more research. And particularly at that stage, it was around low back pain and beliefs around low back pain. And that then segued into osteoarthritis, where there are also some similarities in terms of the impact of beliefs on people. And so that then grew into an academic career, I guess. So now I spend 4 days of my week working for a university doing research and teaching, primarily of medical students. And then I still have a day a week that I spend in the clinic where I work as a physiotherapy specialist in private practice. So most of my days are doing academic work, but then I have a real step change on the clinic day where I am just interacting with the person who I'm consulting with at that given point in time. And it's really nice to have that balance, I guess, across my life.
And, you know, just drawing upon that, obviously you spent quite a number of years just working in clinical practice, and you've obviously made the conscious decision that you want to continue in clinical practice. Rather than for me to preface the question with an answer, why is that?
Look, I think I get quite different rewards from those different areas. And so research is a very long-term game. And often you don't get a real sense of the work you're doing creating value and meaning for people. Teaching is more of a middle game, I guess, in many ways, and that you can certainly see your students' growth in their knowledge and their interest and engagement, but there's still a midterm strategy that hopefully it's supporting and empowering them to do good work in the future. But then there's the direct interaction with the patients, where you're getting very direct feedback as to, you know, whether or not you're having a positive influence on someone's life. And so I think balancing that out is quite nice, but also all three of those pillars support each other. So there are questions that arise for me in the clinic that then I can think of ways of trying to answer with the research. And then the other way, there are things I learn through the research that I can test through the clinic. And so it comes into a nice ecosystem, but it can be challenging to try and juggle your time at times.
Yeah, no, I completely understand. And obviously that's a perspective that I share with you, both in terms of making sure that I continue in clinical practice, but also the struggle to maintain balance and perspective, where you know that a lot of, for example, your academic colleagues that you work with and collaborate with, but ultimately also potentially compete with for grants, are full time and don't get necessarily distracted by clinical practice nor teaching. I definitely share that passion with you, and I think continue stress to all of my colleagues the importance of maintaining clinical practice for the relevancy it creates for the research that you do and that bi-directional feedback that you just spoke about. Now, I'm going off on a tangent here, which I do tend to do, but Ben, when you're not at work, what do you enjoy doing?
I love to be outside in the outdoors, in mountains, in bush and wildlife areas. I like to run. I like to cycle. I like to tramp. I love to ski when I can, particularly on Mount Ruapehu. So yes, I guess I'm an active relaxer overall, but you know, I do enjoy reading and socializing and good food as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And for anybody who hasn't had the privilege of going to New Zealand, Ben lives essentially in the paradise for people who want to get out and hike and bike and those sorts of things. It's a beautiful part of the world to do that. And I would thoroughly recommend it for people who have a passion about doing those sorts of things. Ben, if you had to just describe yourself in 5 words, what would they be?
I think the first one would be active, because I'm active in most of what I do and actively engaged in it. I am curious, and that stimulates a lot of my work. And I am collaborative. I like to work with a range of people and be able to integrate and learn from those perspectives. I'm critical, both in terms of self-critical and hypocritical, as well as critical of ideas. And I'm relatively reflective, which I guess is a blessing, but when it verges on rumination, could be a curse.
Yeah. I mean, see, you took the positive and negative out of every one of those words as you were describing them. But I think at least what I've seen from you, I would imagine most of it tends to err on the side of the positive elements of those descriptors. And the conversation that we're about to have really stemmed from some interactions we had recently when I had the privilege to go and visit you and your colleagues at the University of Otago in Dunedin for a workshop that you all organized, that you presented at, about a topic that I think is really, really important for our listeners about both misconceptions, but also beliefs about osteoarthritis, but also, I guess, ideally, what people with osteoarthritis should know. So let's start with the beliefs, Ben, if that's okay. But based upon the work that you and others have done, what do people with osteoarthritis believe?
From and my thoughts, I guess, are primarily informed by qualitative interviews. So face-to-face interviews that we've done with people who live with osteoarthritis, particularly with osteoarthritis of the knee. And the overriding belief that came through was a belief that osteoarthritis is purely a condition of structural deterioration of a joint surface. So people's understanding of the condition was very defined by images of cartilage loss and degradation and joint damage, but also that that was a sign of getting old. And so something that indicated to them an age and stage that they were at, or that their joints were at, that may well be different from their own biological age. And because of those two, the combination of those two ideas, there was then this sense, this expectation of progressive degradation of that, and that it was a one-way trip that would only get worse from henceforward, and that people had this sort of window of time that they wanted to try and make the most of their joint whilst it was still functioning in some degree. But they had a real concern that every time they used the joint, they were compounding and aggravating those factors and therefore shrinking that window of time, with the expectation that eventually they would need their joint to be replaced. And so people were quite high certainty about that and didn't really feel a need for further information to supplement those ideas because they had such a strong belief that this was the way it was. But then they had some real uncertainty around things like, well, why do my pain and other symptoms vary from day to day or week to week when my understanding of the joint is that it's, you know, that what I feel directly relates to how that looks? And, you know, what should I do? What can't I do? That wasn't necessarily... they hadn't had good answers on how to best manage their themselves going forwards.
Yeah, it sounds like an incredibly negative perception or a misconception, if you like, of that story of decay or degradation, aging and getting old, and obviously that one-way street towards decline as opposed to what truly is happening. And so that's what they believe. And I would imagine, based upon much of the literature that abounds around this, both from you and others, you might frame much of that belief as myths or misconceptions or inaccuracies about that understanding. But they've obviously developed those beliefs as a consequence of something. Why do you think people with osteoarthritis believe those concepts that you just spoke about?
I think a lot of it traces back to us as health professionals in terms of the models and explanations that we have used historically that may still be being used in some contexts around arthritis being a condition of wear and tear. That may have been terms, I think, that clinicians developed from a good intent of wanting to not make it seem as scary as osteoarthritis might be as a term, but at the same point, it communicates to people every time they use their joint, they wear it out. And then going towards the bone-on-bone type descriptions that people get, that then really reinforces that eventually you wear away your joint to being nothing. And so I think those sorts of messages and the focus of health systems very much on providing treatments just for the joint That is a strong influence on focusing people down to just looking at those things. But there's also the community understandings of, you know, the imagery that's put on TV when people are selling medications for joint pain, or even our Arthritis New Zealand ads used to have images of red shards of glass being ground into joints. So that imagery and looking at people's own images with their x-rays and scans reinforces that. But then their lived experience, because based upon those existing beliefs, if then with joint pain you have noises associated with it, you can see how people conflate that into assuming that those noises are to do with causing further damage to their joint. Their experiences when they do more activity load and use their joint more, their pain gets worse, maybe their swelling gets worse. Well, then their lived experience reinforces that idea that using this joint is bad for it. And so it's the confluence of all of those different beliefs coming together and supporting each other that I think makes people so certain that that is what the truth is.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a challenging context, which, as you say, is probably being maintained both by health professionals and community perceptions, and will be hard to change. But obviously, we'll get back into that a little bit later in the conversation. But before we do that, just in an effort to, I guess, expand a little bit upon the patient experience, the patient beliefs, but probably more importantly, in the first instance, their knowledge. What do people who have osteoarthritis know about their condition?
I mean, yeah, beliefs and knowledge are relatively interrelated, I would say. And knowledge is a belief that people feel like there is more evidence that corroborates. And so those beliefs that I talked about, I think most people would view those as knowledge. It's what they know about their knee. But I think people also know that when they are active, they are healthier people. They know that it lifts their mood. They know it's good for their more general health if they're more active and engaged. They know that they enjoy spending time with their friends and whānau. They know that being at work is good for their health. So there's lots of other intersecting areas of knowledge that they hold. But I think the real challenge that people are left with is the trying to balance the knowledge they have about their joint and what they can and can't do or should and should not do, and knowing what else is valuable in their lives and what they'd love to engage in, and having to feel like they're making trade-offs between those two things, I think is what really puts people in a hard position, because they are always feeling like they're sacrificing something that is important to them. And I think for me, that's where I see the real opportunity, with actually a lot of the trade-offs people are making are based upon information that I think we've got different ways of looking at and evidence that's emerged over time that might actually help them to use that information to make choices that are consistent with their own goals and values.
So let's step on from that. And so when you say that they have these misplaced beliefs and their activity and their attitude towards disease stems from that, in your clinical practice, or when you're teaching students, or when you're framing this for the community of people who's trying to better understand osteoarthritis and what we should do, how do you frame this condition, and how do you frame what people should know or believe for osteoarthritis?
Yeah, I think the key starting point is that osteoarthritis is a process, not an end point. It's a process of joint change, and our bodies change across our lives. And there are changes that occur within a joint that might cause that joint to hurt or to swell or do other things. But because it's a process and it's something that's been going on for much longer than the joint has been symptomatic in any way, it means it's something that can be influenced by the person, because processes are constantly in flux dependent upon the way that the system is influenced. And I think looking at it as something that actually has the capacity for the person to have power and autonomy over changing is really important. but also the expanding the understanding of what that process influences away from just those joint surfaces to broadening out to the other parts of the joint linings, the capsule and the membranes that create the fluid that helps to feed and nourish that joint, but also the muscles that empower that joint to move and support it, and the nerves that are communicating information from that joint to the brain and back. And all of those tissues are affected by this condition. And that means they're all opportunities to have a positive influence on the condition. And particularly most people have experience of or understanding of training muscles to perform better. And so then all of a sudden the opportunities that are available expand, which then changes it from being something whereby the person thinks it could only get worse. And actually our data on that is that for the majority of people, in fact, symptoms stay stable over long periods of time. And for some people, they get better. And if that becomes the expectation rather than the much smaller group for whom things do get progressively worse, well, then that starts to open up hope. And I think hope then inspires all sorts of things. So I think those are the key messages that I tend to look at, is that one, it's a process of change. Two, it's a process that you can influence. Three, the outcome can be improved. And, you know, even without anything, may stay stable over long times. And that using the joint does not wear it out, but actually feeds the joint and helps to keep it healthy, as well as allowing the persons to still stay engaged in the things that they value in life.
Yeah, I mean, that message and the way you framed that is incredibly empowering. And obviously, presumably as a consequence of that, as you say, the reframing can help a person to be proactive in managing their disease and presumably benefit from the activity that otherwise they might have suppressed. The way you framed it is obviously challenging for many healthcare professionals and potentially for patients who are out there who have osteoarthritis. They're not necessarily hearing that from their healthcare professionals. You've written about this. Obviously, we're talking about it today. Are there helpful sources of information that you'd encourage people to tap into if they want to learn more about the type of messaging that you're providing, whether you want to frame that as an empowerment discourse or whatever you want to frame it? Are there other types of information, sources of information that you think might be helpful in building better knowledge and helpful beliefs?
Certainly from the way that I view this condition and what's emerged from our research, we've got a website called freefromkneepain.org. And so those messages are expanded on there. Obviously, with joint action, there's good information for people that they can access through that as well. In New Zealand, we've got a health information resource that covers a whole range of different conditions called Healthify, previously known as Health Navigator, where, again, there is information for people there about osteoarthritis that's very consistent with the messages we've talked about today. So I think those are, you know, reasonable resources. And certainly if there were clinicians that happened to come across this as well, we have done work on training clinicians to try and support them to deliver those messages. And that training will be available to everyone through that website by the first quarter of next year.
Wonderful. That's fantastic, Ben. And, you know, obviously strongly encourage you to continue the important work that you're doing in that space. I would imagine for the average person that has osteoarthritis, building those knowledge, building the helpful beliefs takes time and is a process. In general, how do you approach supporting a person through that as they're acquiring knowledge and presumably confidence in what their joints can do? Are there things that you do to help a person through that journey, so to speak?
Yeah, I think experiential learning is really vital to it. So we need to have an initial discussion around how someone is looking at their condition to understand where the differences are to how I might look at it and explore why aspects of that I look at differently, and the information sources I've used to inform that, so that we've got curiosity about maybe this might be something different. And then we can set up some changes in behavior or activity that would support a certain way of looking at this, and then support the person to develop a plan for how they might test those behaviors. And then we can look at, well, what did we learn from that, and adjust and modify based upon that. And so that the person can progressively develop behaviors that work well within their own context and their own lives, but that are likely to move them towards their goals.
Yeah, I think that's incredibly important that it be an iterative process, and that you continue to seek feedback from the health professional that you're engaging with, and not to take the intermittent day that might not be as favorable as a really bad sign that things have deteriorated beyond help, but that potentially might be one of the natural fluctuations or flares that we see in the course of the disease. And you know, if you do some activity and it produces some discomfort around the knee, potentially that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it might just be a sign that you're using muscles that potentially haven't been used that way for a while. So, you know, go back, seek help, seek support from the people who are coaching you through this process, and make sure that you get that feedback in a way that hopefully will help you to foster a very positive journey. So, Ben, what we'll do is we'll include some of those links that you mentioned a moment ago, but another resource that people may find helpful in this regard is a conversation I had with Samantha Bunsley about that impairment versus empowerment type discourse that we mentioned a moment ago that people might want to tap into. But is there anything else that you want to mention about the topic before we move on?
No, I think we have covered that relatively well. I guess my encouragement to people is that, you know, when thinking about what you just said about, you know, continuing to seek feedback from clinicians, I would hope that people's clinicians are continually seeking feedback from them to enable them to individualize what they're providing, because people are not all the same, and what works for one person would work quite differently for another. But also to mention to your clinician, if they are saying things that are inconsistent with some of those resources that we've directed people to, because that then gives the clinician an opportunity to explore whether or not the models that they are using are being interpreted in the way that they intended, or whether there are different ways that they could go about explaining things. So that we can all support the community to look at things differently. And same with interactions with your family and relatives and friends, because often we all focus, you know, as humans, we're very biased towards minimizing threat and looking for negative stuff. And helping them to look at things in different ways then means that that very negative, vicious sort of cycle we talked about earlier, everyone reinforcing negative beliefs, you know, we can all play a role in influencing to move towards more positive ones.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. And particularly with, you know, some of the resources that you mentioned a moment ago about helping health professionals to use a dialogue or discourse that's actually helpful in promoting some of those beliefs can come from patients providing those suggestions to the healthcare professionals that maybe at this point in time reinforcing those more negative beliefs or behaviors. So Ben, in large part because I'm inquisitive to learn about many of the people that I have the privilege to speak with, but if you could do anything to improve health and healthcare, what would you choose to do? Essentially, you had the magic wand, funding was limitless. It's your choice. What would you do?
I would support and enable everyone to enjoy physical activity across their lifespan. Because I see that as being such a vital part of whom we are as humans and keeping us healthy and enabling people to manage so many different aspects of their health. And we're not just talking about physical health, we're talking about mental health and social health, community health. So I think that would be the thing that I would, yeah, most like our health system to put a lot more emphasis on than it currently does.
Yeah, I would similarly love to see that happen. Any thoughts or suggestions as to how you move a health system away from reacting to illness and chronic disease to one where it's proactively supporting people to promote health?
I think I've also got an interest in interprofessional practice. So bringing different disciplinary skill sets and expertise together. And I think one of the challenges with government is that our health department is completely separate from our education department and completely separate from our social support agency. And the mechanisms by which the health system would be able to deliver that, they can't do it within hospitals and within clinics. It has to be done out in communities, has to be done earlier in life. And so, you know, I think it would be to try and support more interaction and interdisciplinary support and sharing between those agencies so that they can all lift up the community together, rather than just being able, having to being mandated to focus only on their own budgets and what they do. Because I think that siloing of things, although it may make the accounting easier, it makes the product much worse.
Yeah, no, I think if we can change behaviors from a much earlier age, whether that be through education or community initiatives that improve determinants of health, I think we'll ultimately make a huge difference.
And also involve more of the community in designing those solutions and what works for them.
Yeah.
Because I think often, again, there's the risk that government develops something that they assume should work, and then it doesn't work well. And so therefore they assume that actually we can't change this behavior, rather than having more confidence in the community to develop solutions that will be more likely sustainable over time.
Yeah, no, it's a key ingredient, isn't it? Ben, what motivates you to do what you do?
I have difficulty sitting with suboptimal processes and outcomes and missed opportunities. And I see there is just so much opportunity to improve people's health and their lives and their enjoyment thereof, that I see it as a real privilege to have the opportunity myself to influence that in a range of ways through those different areas of practice that we talked about earlier in the interview. So it's the seeing the opportunity and then seeing movement towards, I guess, that, you know, really keeps me motivated to keep doing what I do. And the wonderful people whom I work with along the way, whether they be patients or students or academic colleagues.
Potentially a segue that wasn't intended from your response there, Ben, but with health professionals, obviously our focus is on individual prescriptions and we treat each person hopefully as an individual that presents to us and tailor management according to what they present with. What proportion of care in our community, and whether that be provided by healthcare systems, by individual health professionals, should be focused towards individual care as distinct from policy change to lead to improved community health, behaviors in schools, changes in education? How much of our attention should be being targeted towards things that happen at a macro scale rather than down on the micro individual patient?
That's a really tough question. I think I would love it if each community clinician was resourced so that 20% of their time was focused on doing work to improve the health of their community rather than doing work to support individuals who are in health need. But my caveat in saying that is I don't know of a community clinician who could meet the health need in their population in 80% of the time they currently have available, because they couldn't do it in 150% of the time they have available. So if the health system was going to realize that opportunity of improving community health and the long-term gains in terms of reducing the cost of ill health, it would need a massive bump in funding to enable that crossover period to occur whilst those new initiatives are being developed, but the existing health need that has grown over the last decades is still being supported. But I think that in the same way that me having my 20% of my time I spend with patients in the clinic really keeps me grounded in what I'm doing and why I'm doing it, I think having 20% of a clinician's time in their community would keep them grounded in what they're doing and why they're doing it, and connected to that community so they much better understand the context within which their patients live, and therefore how to best support them to be, you know, live their best lives within that context.
Well said, and hopefully something like that can come to pass in our lifetime, Ben. But obviously, while we continue to pontificate, we're probably using up some of that 20% that we'd otherwise be out in the community. In closing, Ben, is there any one piece of advice, knowledge or wisdom that you'd like to impart for people living with osteoarthritis?
The key thing is that you can do something to influence your health and the health of your joint. What that is different for different people, but don't accept someone telling you that it just is what it is.
Yeah, that's a great way to close, because I think unfortunately at this point in time, many people's beliefs that stem from some of the misconceptions that are spread through healthcare professionals in particular lead to a passive approach to the management of their disease. And I think there's a lot of things that could be improved by a more proactive, empowering approach. Ben, thank you so much for spending a little bit of time with us, sharing your insights and knowledge that you've made a massive contribution to for osteoarthritis. And hopefully our audience will have gained immensely from your sharing that with us today.
Well, thanks very much, David. I really enjoyed the conversation.
So I hope you found that discussion today helpful, both in terms of potentially reframing unhelpful beliefs that you might currently have about osteoarthritis, and hopefully doing so in a way that's empowering towards you taking more active control over this disease, osteoarthritis. It's not a one-way street. It's not one of continued decline. And for the vast majority of you who are out there, if you empower yourself with appropriate beliefs and knowledge, you can make a massive difference to the course of your disease. These are simple concepts that oftentimes take a while to grapple with. But as long as you do attain some helpful beliefs, follow those with purposeful activity to help yourself and the disease that you're trying to manage, it will lead to better outcomes longer term. So we'll include a lot of the links that Ben shared with us today in the show notes. Again, really hoping that the content that you're finding in the podcast is helpful for you living with osteoarthritis. Thank you again so much for your continued support, and we look forward to talking to you again relatively soon. But between now and then, please do take care of yourself.
Thanks for listening to Joint Action with David Hunter. If you like our show and want to know more, visit www.jointaction.info. If you have any questions, you can email us at hello@jointaction.info and follow us on Twitter at jointaction.org. This podcast was hosted by David Hunter, edited by Vicky Duong, music produced by Jordan Hunter. The information posted on this podcast is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent disease. Anyone seeking medical advice should consult a health professional.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.